bringing you up to speed on the latest in conservation, science, and responsible hunting in Canada. Hey everyone, it's Mark Hall, and you're listening to the Round Canada Podcast. Hey everybody, welcome to the first episode of the Around Canada podcast in 2024. A little bit late getting this one out this month. It was actually kind of quiet in Canada kicking off the new year for news stories in the topics that we like to cover on this show. But now there's some cool news stories from across the country that I'll cover for you. So the first one is changes to Canada's hunting regulations for migratory birds. So currently there is the Government of Canada public consultation process for changes to the hunting regulations for migratory birds across the country in each one of the provinces and territories. As you know, that's regulated federally. So it's the federal government that's got the public consultation out. If you're interested in reading the proposed hunting changes, go on to the Government of Canada, canada.ca website, look for the Environment Climate Change Division, Migratory Game Bird Hunting, and you'll should find the place where the public can make comments on proposed regulations in your area. So couple of stories about proposed changes for migratory birds that are currently in the package for the upcoming next couple years. The first one is that Ontario is considering having a sandhill crane hunt. So we know recently, over the last several years, sandhill crane hunts have been brought into parts of Alberta, Saskatchewan. We don't really have that many here in British Columbia. They tend not to come on the west side of the Rocky Mountains, but through the central and eastern flyways, they're doing pretty good. So Ontario's looking at having a hunt. So this story was released by the Ontario Federation of Anglers and Hunters. And so they said the seasons for sandhill cranes are being considered in portions of the Hudson James Bay, Northern and Central Waterfowl Districts in Ontario. The Ontario Federation of Anglers and Hunters, in the newsletter that I received from them, talked about this new proposal. Ontario is an important breeding and staging ground for Canada's eastern population of sandhill cranes. As one of three populations in Canada, eastern cranes migrate from the Hudson James Bay region of Ontario and central Quebec down through the Great Lakes and into the U.S. each fall and winter. The eastern population has been growing steadily since the 1970s, with an estimated 6% annual growth in Ontario since 2011. With this population of cranes now well beyond historic recovery objectives, managers are looking to create a season with an appropriate 0.5 to 1% yearly population harvest rate. So sandhill crane and sandhill crane hunting, you know, it's been a big thing in especially the eastern U.S. And I think, at least for myself, it was kind of popularized, I guess, by Steve Rinella on the Meat Eater show. And he coined, and I don't know whether he actually coined this, but it seems to be where I remember it, calling sandhill cranes the ribeye of the sky. So everybody seems to be using that term now to do with sandhill cranes. A few years ago, a friend of mine brought one back, dropped it off at my place. He got one hunting in Saskatchewan and said, here, give this a try. So I've had the sandhill cranes. They're pretty cool. They're long, gangly birds. And for such a tall bird, they're kind of definitely got a very small frame, but a nice little, you know, breast meat on them that's, you know, maybe about the size of a small goose, a large pheasant, somewhere kind of in that range. But so a little bit about sandhill cranes, this kind of piqued my interest a little bit and kind of dig into them. It's kind of the way I like to operate. So there are six subspecies of sandhill cranes in North America. The lesser sandhill crane, the Cuban sandhill crane, the Florida sandhill crane, the Mississippi sandhill crane, the Canadian sandhill crane, and the greater sandhill crane. Interestingly enough, these are pretty ancient birds. So the oldest known fossil is around 10 million years old. It came out of Nebraska. Scientists think that it may not have actually been the modern sandhill crane. It may have been a prehistoric relative of the modern sandhill crane. But fossils of the current modern sandhill crane have been found in North America, dating back between 1.8 and 2.5 million years ago in their present form. So they kind of, you know, those are very much like in line with North America's wild turkey. I believe the prehistoric predecessor, Regiminoris, I think was the Latin name, the wild turkey, was found somewhere, I think, in Florida, and it was around 10 million something years old, where the modern wild turkey timeframes kind of are Pleistocene kind of post epochs of those two epochs. So very similar birds as far as game birds that we're hunting today in North America that are basically prehistoric. So in North America in the 1930s, the sandhill cranes had been pretty much extirpated east of the Mississippi River. But since then, like a lot of the conservation success stories in North America, their populations have recovered. They're around 100,000 in the eastern Mississippi area as of about 2018. And they've had quite a year-to-year increase in that part of the area. So Nebraska's Platte River and the Mississippi River is kind of like the big spot where all the sandhill cranes, the central and eastern flyways, funnel down into on their annual migration. The sandhill crane is generally not considered as a threatened species anywhere in North America, but the three southernmost subspecies are considered to be quite rare. So by the three southernmost subspecies, I'm assuming they're talking about the Cuban, the Florida, and the Mississippi sandhill cranes. Not threatened, but not very common. Now, in Nebraska is like famous, Nebraska's Platte River, for where all these sandhill cranes congregate on their migration in the fall. So 80% of all the sandhill cranes in North America use a 75-mile stretch of the Platte River in Nebraska. In 2023, in the central Platte River Valley in Nebraska, there was an estimated 1.26 million sandhill cranes. And that estimate is 83% higher than what was estimated the previous year in 2022. So unless there was like a complete screw up in estimating the number of birds, man, an 80% increase from 2022 to 2023 in the Central Platte River Valley. That's crazy. In Canada, the reports I've read said they figure there's between 500,000 and 600,000 breeding birds in Canada. So it's looking favorable for Ontario in 1, 2, 3 of its waterfowl districts to get a sandhill crane season, maybe starting this fall. Now, not all groups across Canada are excited about all the changes that are being proposed in the migratory bird hunting regulations that are currently up for public comment. So in Prince Edward Island, the Canadian Wildlife Service has confirmed that they're going to, or they put this into the regulation proposal changes to extend the waterfowl hunting season in PEI by 15 days. That proposal was adopted by the Atlantic Migratory Game Bird Technical Committee, which is a international game bird committee that is like authorized under the International Migratory Bird Convention, the treaty. And so there's, because the birds are transboundary, there is a committee, an international committee for each one of the flyways that actually goes through population data, habitat data, bird breeding status, harvesting, and they vet each country's, the United States and Canada's, hunting regulations through the technical committee. So this one, this extension in PEI, was got the thumbs up from the Atlantic Migratory Game Bird Technical Committee. So what it's doing is it's extending, so under the Canada's Migratory Bird Convention Act. So each country, the U.S. and Canada, has a Migratory Bird Convention Act, which is the federal or national legislation that will give the direction or authorize how the countries will manage migratory game birds under the international treaty. So it's basically each country's way of legally implementing the agreements of the international treaty. One of the things that's in the international treaty is that Canada and the U.S. agrees that in each jurisdiction that the migratory hunting season won't be longer than 107 days. So what this change in PEI does, the 15-day extension, will bring that hunting season in PEI up to the maximum 107 days for that jurisdiction. So it's the maximum allowed under Canada's Migratory Bird Convention Act, or that's agreed to in the international treaty. A group in PEI called Hunters for Conservation don't like this extension, primarily because the extension is going to come on the end of the hunting season. And one of the group's primary concerns is that the hunting season is now running into the winter conditions. Then when water starts to freeze up and the available space on open water starts to shrink and birds get concentrated, they're more susceptible to be shot. So they're thinking from a conservation perspective that 15 days on the end of the season is not good for waterfowl, because they're, you know, easier to get shot out, I guess. So, you know, as you know, ducks and geese move into big water bodies late in the year, small water bodies, as they start to freeze up, you see them trying to pack into it and make it available space. And then finally, they're just sort of like, screw it, that's it, we're out of here, and bang, they're heading their way down to the Gulf of Mexico. So this group, Hunters for Conservation and PEI, are concerned probably about that very narrow window of time, probably like a couple of weeks, late November, early December, where, you know, these small areas of open water in the freezing spaces is going to make the waterfowl get over harvested. So apparently the Canadian Wildlife Service biologists and the Atlantic Migratory Technical Committee didn't share those same concerns about over harvesting. The Government of Canada's Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans recently just released its final report as a result of a public consultation process titled Ecosystem Impacts and Management of Pinniped Populations. So it's essentially looking at seal and sea lion populations on east, west, and the north coasts of Canada. The way it works, the standing committees, there's all different types of standing committees throughout Canada, standing committees on finance. This one's the Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans. People that represent different groups and even individuals go speak and give testimonials in front of these standing committees, who then basically listen to what everybody has to say from, like I said, industry, business owners, commercial sector representation, conservation groups, scientists from universities, so on and so on, that give, you know, their statements and testimony on something. They compile it all together, produce a report, and then a list of recommendations. So the go round of presentations that were made to the Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans last fall, that were the basis of this report, included a bunch of people that we work with here at Blood Origins Canada, take advice from, get information from, that help support us. We've had a few of these people on our podcast before, which includes the Fur Institute of Canada's executive director, Doug Chesson, program manager of SEALS and Sealing Network, Rami Vajwa, the executive director of the BC Wildlife Federation, Jesse Zeman, and owner of a seal products business called Natural Boutique, Jen Shears, all gave testimonies to the Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans about pinniped populations in Canada. So generally the interest in the industry representation, the scientists, these groups that I just mentioned here, are generally said it's a good report. It's moving pinniped management in Canada in the right direction. Overall, some of these folks on that I just mentioned have said, yeah, we're generally pretty happy with the recommendations that were included in the Standing Committee's report. A few of the really key areas that were discussed that had some movement on was an agreement for the Government of Canada to start working on new international markets for Canada's seal products, being both the fur and the meat and various health products that come from the omega-3s and whatnot that come from seal harvesting. So working on expanding international markets. There was some recommendations and discussions around the barriers that still exist out there in the world to Canada's getting its seal products into the market, continuing to work on those countries and regions with bans. The two primary barriers to Canada's seal products industry is the United States Marine Mammal Protection Act, which prohibits marine mammal products from being imported into the U.S., and the European Union ban on Canada's seal products and polar bear products actually as well. So people were generally happy with Canada recognizing that it needs to work internationally, opening up markets, continuing to chisel away at the misinformation in markets. There was also recommendations for the Government of Canada. What did they call? All on board, all government on board. So kind of everybody has in the Government of Canada has a responsibility for addressing misinformation about Canada's seal harvesting sector with respect to humane harvesting, its seal industry, and its Indigenous peoples' rights and livelihoods that revolve around pinniped population management, harvesting, and ability to sell products. A couple other key recommendations were is the continuing of the East Coast seal harvesting opportunities, both the commercial industry and residents having opportunities to harvest seals, and also some discussion or recognition on the impacts of a growing pinniped population on the West Coast being tied to some of the declines of salmon stocks. And not so much explicit in the language, but implied they're moving towards recognizing or bringing in a West Coast seal sea lion hunt, which would also probably mean that Indigenous people on the West Coast that can currently harvest pinnipeds but can't sell the products may have some barriers lifted on the West Coast, so that Indigenous communities can access markets with Pinniped products as well for rural and coastal community sustainable livelihood, you know, issues. Last year, last fall, I covered a story about this invasive species of a crayfish that was found in Ontario. So a pond in Ontario was the first place in North America where scientists had discovered the marbled crayfish found in the wild. It was a pond in Ontario. Now, the bizarre thing about this marbled crayfish, so it's an invasive species, which gets into a native ecosystem where it doesn't belong. It expands its population and has all these impacts on the native species in the native ecosystem. So the marbled crayfish is listed as an invasive species that can be detrimental. Well, the bizarre thing about the marbled crayfish was its ability to clone itself. So it's called a self-replicating crayfish. So through cloning, one crayfish can just start cloning itself and spitting out replicas of itself to completely populate a pond or, you know, a lake or whatever and take over. And it's science fiction stuff. Like, it's just bizarre. I had no idea that crayfish or very many species in the world could actually self-replicate. But anyway, since I covered that story, some scientists in a working group that's responding to this detection, finding the marbled crayfish in the wild in Ontario, has reported that they think it seems that the population has been contained in this one pond because it was drained last fall. So the pond was drained. They think they wiped out the marbled crayfish. And so far, they haven't been able to find it in any other adjacent areas. They actually think the marbled crayfish got into this pond in the first place. There was a pet purchased from a pet store that somebody ditched. So that's a pretty common story when it comes to invasive species is pets gone wild. I've also covered stories last year about Quebec's endangered boreal caribou. So just recently, a peer-reviewed research paper was published in an academic journal called Land that reported that in Quebec, that logging practices between 1976 and 2020 resulted in the loss of 14 million hectares of old-growth boreal forest, an area roughly twice the size of New Brunswick. So the boreal subspecies of caribou, the endangered boreal caribou in Quebec, is a boreal caribou, a forest caribou. It's dependent on the boreal forest. So it's not caribou that are wandering around in the open or like the mountain caribou or barren ground and stuff. These are like forest dwelling caribou. And so they're heavily dependent on old growth forest. So this report said that, you know, they've known about the endangered caribou, their dependence on old growth forest. Yet Quebec has logged 14 million hectares of it since 1976. Of course, the federal government has been critical of both Ontario and Quebec for not protecting caribou habitat and continuing to log caribou habitat. Last year, early in the fall, I think the Environment Minister, Stephen Guilbeault, threatened both Ontario and Quebec about using the Species at Risk Act to impose stricter rules on the provinces. And, you know, you've heard me talk about that lots. It just never seems to really happen, and business as usual. And, you know, endangered caribou continue to have their habitats logged. In this study that was just released, scientists looking at satellite imagery of government data found that there are only 8 patches of old growth forest that were greater than 500 square kilometers left still intact between Ontario and Quebec. So like a lot of forest-dependent wildlife. It's not just that they need like little patches of forest here and there. They generally need large contiguous patches of forest to, you know, almost occupy their entire home range within. So 500 square kilometers is not really that big, but they only found 8 patches in Ontario and Quebec that could really, you know, support caribou in those patches, and fragmented, you know, habitat and clear cuts and developments and stuff between those 8 patches. So fairly isolated and not well connected. So continuing to follow the story about Quebec and Ontario's boreal caribou, and this whole story of logging in endangered caribou habitat is just a story that's been plaguing Canada for years and years now. Maybe one day I'll have a good caribou forest habitat news story to cover. In Alberta, I remember last fall also, I covered a story about all this fervor in Alberta that the province wasn't going to replace its grizzly bear conflict specialist after that person retired. Just recently, the provincial government in Alberta announced that it's going to spend $700,000 over the next 5 years to prevent conflict between ranchers and large carnivores, grizzly bears and wolves, in southwestern Alberta. Data on grizzly bears from the Waterton Biosphere Region, so the Waterton region of southwestern Alberta, that was gathered between 2011-2014, showed that the grizzly bear population was growing in that region, which is to some the reason why they're seeing grizzly bears ranging east in Alberta, out of the Rockies, east out into the parkland and even into the prairie region. So these funds, the $700,000 over 5 years, is going to go to an organization called the Waterton Biosphere Reserve Association, their Carnivore and Communities Program, which is a program of individuals and program assistants and whatnot that's helping to keep predators, wolves and grizzly bears, away from rural properties. For example, one of the things that the Biosphere Reserve Association has been doing is they've been helping farmers manage attractants by picking up dead farm animals for free and moving those off to proper disposal areas. So getting them away from cattle ranching operations, dead cows and whatnot, and probably some horses as well. And because that's attracting wolves and coyotes. I've seen that where a cow dies on a cow ranch operation and they picked it up and with a tractor and drove it over and dropped it over the fence on the outside of the cow operation. And up and down that fence line, it was just the snow was just beaten down by a wolf pack that patrolled the fence every, you know, week looking for a dead cow to be flipped over on the other side of the fence. So all they needed was an opportunity to go through the fence or under it and go in and try to get one of the undead cows in the farmer's field. So not a good idea having something as big as a dead cow hanging around your cattle ranch if you got wolves and grizzly bears in the area. So anyways, this $700,000, that's part of what the Waterton Biosphere Reserve Association is going to do, is continue this picking up dead animal program. Kind of reminds me of the show there. What are the guys? They were like, bring out your dead. I'm not dead. So Monty Python, that's it. Bring out your dead. So that bring out your dead cows is program is going to carry on in the Waterton area of Alberta. Also, the association is helping to provide funds for farmers to pay for electric fences around food storage areas and grain bin storage areas as well, in order to keep most likely grizzly bears out of those. So, I mean, a good news story in a way. It's community members helping community members, and People don't want to see grizzly bears and wolves cause problems with ranchers and ag operators. Nobody wants to see these animals killed because of human attractants. So seems like a win-win situation. $700,000 seems like a lot of money. Over 5 years, it's not really a lot of money. So hopefully it's enough to do a really good job of keeping grizzly bears and wolves away from farm and ag areas in southern Alberta. Hopefully I'll find out some more about that in the coming months this year. Well, that's kind of everything that's gone on of interest in wildlife science, conservation, and responsible hunting in Canada since the January 1st, the new year. So you're up to date on what's going on around Canada. If you got a new story from your region, reach out, let me know. Not all the cool stories that are happening in the country that I pick up on are from major news outlets. Some of these stories come from people like you that know something that's going on. So help me out. Help me communicate what's going on in your area to the rest of the country. I think everybody likes hearing these different stories of what's going on. And if they're cool little stories about conservation, science, or responsible hunting or fishing or trapping or whatever that maybe is not mainstream media news, reach out, mark@bloodorigins.com, and I'll work with you to get a news story together and cover it on an episode of the Around Canada podcast. All right, everybody, I'll talk to you in the next episode.